Okay, the first question this evening. Sometimes mindfulness is spoken of in terms of not bumping into things, seeing things clearly and brightly, etc. Sometimes it is used to mean the gatekeeper of the mind, according guarding off unwholesome mind states, welcoming wholesome mind states. Does mindfulness just mean vigilant? Is the gatekeeper vigilance and right effort? Yeah, because like you've got carefulness, I suppose part of mindfulness, and not bumping into things. But the thing is, you're only mindful of one thing. You can only put a few things in the mind. And sometimes if you're doing, say, walking meditation, and you're getting really into walking meditation, you're very, very, very mindful of your feet. You're not very mindful of the time for lunch. You're not very mindful of other things which you're supposed to be doing. And that's why walking meditation is great, but don't try it when you're crossing a busy road. Because you'll be mindful of your feet, but not of the cars coming to you. So, say when you're driving the car. Now sometimes you can try to be mindfulness of the breath when you're driving the car, but it's much better to be mindful of your speedometer. So the thing is, that those are examples there. With mindfulness, there has to be sort of the most important thing you're doing at the time. And the main object, and that's what you put your mindfulness on. So when you choose your main object, it's the same as like present moment awareness. Sometimes people, when I first mention present moment awareness, they say, no, what am I supposed to be doing? And they get confused. And so like mindfulness takes the present moment as the main object. It doesn't matter what you're aware of, as long as it's in the present moment. So you make the present moment the main thing, the most important object which you're watching. After a while you get to find out what that present moment is. Through familiarity you get very clear about what this present moment awareness is. When you first try it, you say, what am I supposed to be doing? What's this present moment of business about anyway? And that's actually when you put mindfulness just on the main thing. And other things are on the periphery. So, sure that sometimes when you get very, very mindful, I was saying that to some people that they're asking, like this morning, how far can you get in walking meditation? And according to Ajahn Yan, who knows lots of these famous monks in Thailand, I left Thailand about 20 years ago, so I've lost touch with you know, who the great monks of today are. He says there is one monk who can get to jhana as well as doing walking meditation. He gets so deep when he's doing walking meditation, completely loses track of his body. But he keeps on bumping into trees. So it's not advisable to do that. Because you're deep inside of yourself, you lose contact with your body. When you're doing sitting meditation, it's easy to lose contact with your body because if you're sitting there, it's not sort of in danger at all. So that's why we usually sit in a comfortable place, secluded place, where there's going to be no danger to us. So mindfulness, depending upon what it's focused on. If you're focusing it because you're driving your car, then it's good to make sure that mindfulness is about not bumping into things. But if it's you're sitting down, you don't have to worry about those things. And so mindfulness has a different aim. Remember that mindfulness is always relative. Mindfulness of something has to have a goal, a purpose, an aim. And then you know what mindfulness is. Is that quite clear? Anyone got any comments on that one? Counter questions? So your next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, we believe rebirth in some case... Dear Ajahn Brahm, we believe rebirth in some case. Is there any intermediate step? Mind bodies, please explain. Yeah, of course. Now, I'll explain this. Next time you get into very, very deep meditation, ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And then you can see for yourself if there was something just before you were born, but after you died. Isn't that interesting to find out? Because this is a question which is in like Theravada Buddhism, because about, was it 200 years after the death of the Buddha, there was a book of the Abhidharma written called Katawatu, Points of Controversy, and in that they sort of were saying, is there such a thing as an antara realm? In other words, a just when you die from this realm, but before you get reborn in another realm? Is there some in-between state? And the guy who wrote that said, absolutely no. And that became standard Theravada Buddhism. However, as many people pointed out, that, you know, that was just the word of one commentator, not the word of the Buddha. And there's many passages actually in the text which actually seem to suggest otherwise. And if you can remember your past lives, or you can actually do those sorts of things, you'll actually see that yes, there is such a state. In other words, that when a person dies, they don't always get reborn straight away. They can linger around for a while. That's why you can see ghosts. Put your hands up if you've seen a ghost. There we go, that's actually quite a good number. I don't mean in the movies. There's quite a few. Because I don't like asking that question, because you usually get, that's actually, when I give talks and ask people their hands up to see the ghost, that's actually quite a good, more than usual. I should actually keep the statistics on this. It'd be interesting to write a paper on actually who believes in ghosts or who's actually seen a ghost. So there is such a thing as ghosts, and I think those of you who know me that I'd like to tell lots of stories about ghosts, but not this evening, because otherwise we won't finish until about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. But when I was at Cambridge University, that was one of the things I was really interested in, and I was a member of the Psychic Research Society. One of my friends, he's still a friend, I saw him only a couple of years ago, a guy called Tony Cornell. He's, even on those days, he was on the Ghost Hunting Council of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. He had it on his business card. It's a great business card to hand out to people, because he's one of the top ghost hunters. He was an expert, and he spent all his life hunting ghosts. And when I saw him a couple of years ago, that was actually at the temple opening at Amawati. Just the day before, I just had some lunch with him and an old Cambridge friend, and he was just about to retire. He's an interesting fellow because he spent all his life investigating ghosts in England. I mean, not just messing around, I mean with all of the equipment and cameras and infrared stuff and stuff like that. And he said heaps of ghosts, but he said it's really one of the weird things about the ghosts is that, you know, you can see them in your cameras and you can almost get the picture, but you never quite. There's always something that goes wrong. He doesn't know exactly why that happens, but you know, you can never actually prove it 100%, but they're there. I mean, it's absolutely certain that they're there, but actually to try and get that picture of a real ghost is just almost impossible. So it's interesting, that's years and years, and he's just about to retire, and he said he spent his whole life trying to get that perfect picture, but can never quite make it. Something always goes wrong. But anyway, sort of, yeah, there is that astral realm, and that's what happens with some ghosts. And these are ghosts, they just stay around for a while and then they go and get reborn. So, if you don't believe me, or if you doubt that, please, the next time you die, come to the Buddhist Society of West Australia. If you're from Singapore, go to the Buddhist Fellowship on a Sunday afternoon and say, here I am, see, prove it. Ajahn Brahm was right. Yeah, it's the same thing. It's just like in the text they say no, but actually as monks they always say these things, that these things actually happen. There is that sort of space in between. As I said, I think it's Singapore, and you get the same question asked. There was this lovely story in this a monk you probably know well. I shouldn't give too much information. But he was a very good monk, a Thai monk. And in this monastery was a monkey. Because, you know, in Thailand, if people have, like, animals who are put in cages, they buy them and they release them in the monastery, because the monastery is sanctuary. So they had this old monkey, which was kept in a cage, and, you know, really treated badly. So they released it in the monastery. And the monkey, because it was close to humans, became very friendly with the monks, especially with the senior monk. And when it was tea time in the monastery, this little monkey would also have his tea, because he had to sort of join in with everything. So this little monkey sitting there with his cup of tea, sipping it while all the monks were sipping it. Really cute. And he would protect the monks. But he'd also, he would chase the cars, because they thought there were noise in the monastery stopping the monks meditating. One day he got killed by one of the cars, the big lorry. Sort of ran over him as he was chasing it away. But the head monk saw what had happened. He's, you know, a very great monk. and saw a stream of consciousness sort of come out of the body and go off into the village where there was a woman who was pregnant and enter her womb. There was a time that between the death and the rebirth, only a little time. And when that little baby was born, it was exceptionally hairy for a young baby. And I don't know what would happen when that baby grows up. For all the monks would call it a little monkey, if you happen to be right. They saw its last birth was a monkey. Because it associated in the monastery, you know, obviously got a bit of good karma there from the other monks, and became a human being, got the human birth. We actually saw it happen. So it would be interesting to see what happens to that sort of young man when he grows up. So if you ever have any children who are exceptionally hairy, it might be that's where they come from in a previous life. So yeah, there is a natural realm. Dear Ajahn Brahm, as someone with a background in psychology, married to a scientist, I was interested to say we could go to hell this morning. Given that I'm also a Buddhist, I thought I ought to find out how to be saved from this eternal damnation. Please can you, with loving kindness to us poor people, explain what your concerns are about psychology and the specific experience on which these are based. I'm very happy to listen and learn. I say you dislike it, you know, saying to go to hell. I was interested to say that we could go to hell. What did I say? I can't remember. I said somebody can go to hell, but I forget which. Oh, did I? Oh boy. I'm in trouble now. That's the trouble when you speak a lot. Eventually you put your foot in the mouth. The more you speak, the wider your mouth, the more chance there's a foot going in it. I think that was about the nature of the mind. What is the mind, I think? And I was saying that all these psychologists and scientists have all these ideas of what the mind is. But in meditation, you're actually seeing the mind. So instead of having speculation, you're actually having real experience. And this is actually that all truth should really come from experience, not from speculation. That's why even like Buddhist truths about enlightenment or nibbana, or just like the antara realm, is there a space between death and rebirth? A lot of times that's just speculation for people. And they think about it and they infer. Basically they haven't got enough evidence to really know for sure. That's why even actually knowing what the mind is, the scientists have not got enough evidence. Same with psychologists. You can think about the mind, you could argue and infer about the mind. But only in deep meditation do you actually come across the mind. You actually see it. Can you actually have it as an object of contemplation? That's why that I maintain that when we go to that path of the Satipatthana, the third Satipatthana, which is contemplating the mind, Cittanupassana, I maintain that the only time you can do that is just before jhanas, when you get nibbidas coming up. Before then you haven't got a clue what you're supposed to be contemplating. That's why before I've given the simile of the nature of the mind, like the simile of the emperor, which is clothed in five garments. That's my simile, that's not in the texts. If you imagine an emperor who's got these big boots on, which go right up to his thighs, and he's got these big trousers on, which cover the boots and go down to his ankles. And they've got this tunic on, which covers the top of the trousers, up to his neck and down to his wrists. He's got these gloves on which cover the tunic, go up halfway up his arm. And he's got this big helmet on which covers his head and his neck. So there's no part of the body exposed. The whole body is covered with these five garments. And so you wonder exactly who this emperor is. You know there's something inside there, but exactly what is it? And that simile, the five garments, stand for the five senses. For sight, hearing, smell, taste, and physical touch. And the emperor stands for the mind. Something behind all of this. And the only way we can find out what the emperor is to take all the clothes off. The only way we can find out what the mind is to allow somehow or other sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch to completely disappear and see what's left. See what's left when you're not seeing anything. So you're not hearing anything. You're not smelling, you're not tasting. And the body sense is completely gone as well. What's left is the mind. You've unclothed the emperor. And that's what happens when nimittas come up in meditation. Seeing, hearing has disappeared. Same as smelling, tasting, and the body is gone. You can't feel anything. Someone taps you on the shoulder, you can't know. The body has disappeared. Or rather the senses, the five senses, have subsided and gone. And what's left is the mind. The sixth sense. That's when you can really get to know the mind. When you get to know the mind, actually you see exactly what it is. First thing you see, which is, should be very, very clear, is this mind has nothing to do with the body. The mind can see without the eyes, it can hear without the ears, it can feel without the body, it can know off and by itself. And it's amazing actually to see that. And you know that when the body just disappears, the five senses shut down. What's the other time when the five senses shut down? What's that called? Death. So what happens when you die? You can't see, you can't hear, you can't smell, you can't taste, you can't touch. The brain stops, but the mind continues on. And this is actually, you see, it's actually what the mind is, and that mind is independent of the body. And that's why you know for sure, it's your own experience, that when you die, when the five senses stop, the brain stops, the mind continues on. You've seen that, you know that. That's what happens. What happens in this astral realm? What do all the people have out of the body experiences say? You go floating out of the body, and then what you do? What do you do? Go towards the light. Have you ever heard me talk about the light before? Nimittas, it's exactly the same thing. When you die, because the five senses disappear, the only thing which is left is this beautiful light in the mind. So that's actually what you're seeing when you die. You see the mind alone. Very often the people actually can go to that light, get drawn to it, but go right through it or bounce out of it. They can't stay in that life. So they go and get reborn somewhere. So when you go into nimittas, sometimes you go into the nimitta, you come out again, you can't stay in there. You can't go into the jhana realms. Because you don't know how to deal with nimittas. So this is actually what happens when a person dies. The five senses disappear. With it the body, you're left with just the mind. Another way you can go into the mind realms, mind-made bodies. But when you're very skilled at these, because you've done sort of this type of meditation, it makes it much easier to die. You know what you're doing. You get training for all sorts of things. We get training for marriage now. Yeah, so you train before you get married. You train before you have a career. This is Ajahn Brahm's training school for death. How to Die seminar. But if we advertise it like this, learn how to die from Ajahn Brahm. I don't think you get many people coming here. So we call it a meditation retreat instead. So this is actually what's happening here. And actually you can see this for yourself. In deep meditation, when you see that nimitta coming up, that's the reflection of your mind. It's like seeing the mind in a mirror. I was never taught that. That's what you saw. And actually, what's your insights, your experience again and again and again. What the heck is this like? And actually, you find out that's called a jitta. And then you sort of start recognizing all these phrases in the suttas about the pabbasara jitta, which is now the radiant mind. Hey, I know there's something which is radiant. It's that nimitta. You get to know that that's the thing we call the jitta, as seen. In a reflection. So that's the only time you can really understand what the jitta really is, what the mind is, what its place in the scheme of things is. So this is actually, how to get on this going to hell business? Oh yeah, about the mind. So that's actually what this mind actually is. And so anyone who like speculates or dreams or argues, those are the people who say, oh, just, what are you wasting time? You're just like armchair philosophers, just like armchair Buddhists as well. All these really fine ideas about emptiness and about nirvana, But what does it really mean if you've got no experience? It's just like empty thinking, that's all. Okay, when the nimitta appears to you, I'll talk about this later on in the retreat, about some of the jobs which you have to do is first of all stabilize that nimitta to make it still. So it's not moving around, it's not doing things, it's just stable, still and peaceful. Same way you stabilize the breath to make it just still, just the breath going in, going out, nothing happening. It's an important trick to be able to do that. One of the problems with meditators is sometimes they get a nimitta coming up too quickly. They haven't learned how to just to hold the breath, the beautiful breath, with stability. And so that just it's like having a hand which isn't dexterous enough. The mind has to be practicing on the beautiful breath for a long time so it can hold that. And then when it lets the beautiful breath go, it can hold the nimitta as well, which is even harder to hold. There's other skills which need to be developed so that limit just stays there for long periods of time. Long enough so you can really reflect upon it. Not that you think about it, but you see it long enough that after the meditation you can recall all those experiences and you know exactly what you've been watching. And the different qualities of the limiter is you start to learn that sort of the particular colour has got no interest whatsoever. But the qualities are like beauty. Radiance, they're the qualities, because that shows one how much energy is in the mind, the brilliance of it, the brightness of it, the bliss of it, and that's like your mental energy. That's how much you've really put in to this knowing business and how much you've taken it away from the doer. The purity of those colours, just how beautiful they are rather than their strength, is the beauty of your conduct, the beauty of your body, speech and mind conduct. And this is where you really find out exactly what you've been doing. If you've been like a heedless person who has been like selfish, has been sort of greedy, has not given donations, not given dana, not helped other people, not been compassionate, been selfish, argumentative, negative, fault-finding, ill-will, then that nimitta will be very dull and dirty. It won't be bright. Show the mind isn't bright. You can understand why people get depressed. They haven't made enough good karma in their life. They haven't got enough energy, brilliance in there. We have to understand what the mind is and how karma brightens up in that mind and makes it brilliant and beautiful. And how because of that beautiful mind, the brilliance of it, just how good rebirths happen. So you get so much insight into just seeing what the mind is and what affects it. Just those two qualities, its power, its beauty. And you can reflect upon that a lot. You find out so much about how rebirth happens and what the karma is. So, but this is what you find out for yourself because you've got the data. And minutes, hours and hours and hours of looking at nimittas, all sorts of different ones. You find out what's going on. What you're actually really doing is you're looking at your jitta in a mirror. So you're really understanding exactly what's going on there. That's how it works. So that citta anupassati is just what happens either just prior to jhana or just afterwards. And that citta, that mind, is just so important to understand the rebirth, to understand the nature of things. That's the knower and that's the doer. That's where that lives. You talk about soul or a being, that's what people take to be a soul. Actually start to investigate it. This thing about a soul, is there a soul, is there not a soul, is there a God, not a God? This is actually where you find out the answers to those things. But you've got to get that thing in your mind first of all and be able to see it for long periods of time to gain enough data that it becomes quite clear what's going on. Make sense? Yeah, sense?
As in, lots of ways you mentioned that it's not always a visual thing.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the reasons why that I always encourage, if you're developing nimittas, to develop the visual ones. The thing is that whether it's a visual nimitta or a feeling nimitta, it's still the same thing, it's just how you perceive it. So sometimes a person can just perceive the feeling rather than perceive it through the mind's eye, as it were. And because that's valid, you can do that, but it's nowhere near as useful and it's nowhere near as certain. So it's a valid vehicle for getting into the jhanas, but it's nowhere near as useful as developing the visual ones. That's why I always encourage people to try and develop the visual nimittas, even if they've got feeling nimittas. Actually, to try and sort of associate that with sort of some visual light. Now look around, you can usually find one. It's only a changing your perception. So it's there, the nimitta is there, that's the mind. It's much more useful to perceive it as a visual thing.
When you've got the questions into the mind with respect to sending the visual down to that, is it, when by definition, if you're in that state of nimitta, you can't think?
You can't think. Absolutely, you can't think. When you have nimittas in front of you, you can't think, you can't drop questions, you can't do anything. Because if you do, you just disturb everything. So what you're just doing is just gathering data. So in order to know something, you just watch it, observe it. You don't think about it yet. You don't draw conclusions yet. You don't even ask questions. You just observe. The longer you observe, then afterwards, sort of things start to click after those images are gone. That's what that was. I understand that now. That's why it looked that way. That's why it was brilliant. That's why it was stable. That's why it was powerful. You just get one limit, so that's not enough. You've got to do many of them. Especially to understand. No, that was a brilliant one. That wasn't a dull one. What was going on? And you start to understand just the connections between the state of mind before you meditated, what you've been up to, what you've been doing. So this is actually how you gather all that data. You know what this jitta is, this mind is, which people talk about. If people say, is there a mind? Is there not a mind? What is this mind? Just go find out. Take off the five garments. Let go of the body. And then what's left is the mind. When you really get to know this, then when you die, first of all, you're not afraid of death, because you know what's going to happen. Because the mind is going to manifest. If you've been looking after your mind, cultivating your mind, making a beautiful mind, you know when you die you can have this beautiful mind. You know exactly what to do with it. That's what happens when you die. So now you know. You can't wait now to die. I know. Next question. Very quickly, and just once more, the five hindrances to meditation. Thank you. Okay, what's the first hindrance? Desire. And what's its antidote? Happiness, yeah. If you're really happy, what do you want in life? If you're a really happy monk, you don't desire anything. If you're unhappy, there's no end to desires. And the next hindrance? Ill will. And what's its antidote? Yeah, that's right. Are you fed up this retreat yet? If you're really fed up with this retreat, I hate this retreat. What am I doing this one for? Loving kindness is what you need. To actually overcome. Wasn't it wonderful, this wonderful retreat? Aren't the people just beautiful here? Great cook, wonderful food, this wonderful company. Oh, it's just so lovely. Loving kindness here, and my mind. Oh, it's so beautiful that my mind has got me so far. Just the present moment awareness sometimes. Oh, it's just wonderful it's got that far, isn't it lovely? So have loving kindness, and then no ill will happens then. And what's the next hindrance? And what's the antidote to stop and topper? Go to bed. Yeah, go on, go for it. And the next hindrance? Restlessness and worry, yeah. What's that hindrance overcome by? Contentment. The last hindrance? Doubt. So whoever asked this question had that last hindrance, and how do you overcome that hindrance? By putting questions on a piece of paper. By asking. By investigating. By finding out. Okay, that's five hindrances. Okay. Ajahn, it is a wonderful feeling. I think I'll stop there. When at the moment of losing your breath, it is like if you are sucked into the abyss. Ah. Is that the abyss or the abyss? No, abyss. Why is it? This only happens only rarely. Very rarely. Okay, a lot of times it happens only rarely because you, as soon as you get into nice states, that craving comes up and spoils it all. Oh, this is really good. I want it again. And as soon as you have wanting, 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 that's in the opposite to peace. As soon as there's wanting, it's just putting more things in your basket, and the balloon goes down, not goes up. You meditate to let go, to abandon, to renounce. You don't meditate to get, to accumulate, to amass experiences or anything else. So remember what you're meditating for. You'll never go in the wrong direction. But if you have good experiences in meditation, you know, just happened to me when I first got the best, nice experience in meditation, just wanting it back again for years and years. And always remember to aspire for the causes. Don't aspire for the result. Create the causes which gave rise to the beautiful meditation. Don't try and create the result. That just solves so many problems for me in my meditation. If you had a good meditation, instead of trying to recreate that good meditation, I tried instead to recreate the causes. How come that meditation came around? Because I let go, I relaxed. You know, I just started with a very happy mind, went very slowly. Just, you know, did all of the watching the present moment, silence, just watched the breath, didn't rush things, didn't sort of have any desires, just filled my mind with contentment. That's how those things happened. So now I know to recreate the causes. You recreate the causes, you're recreating letting go, and there's no desire there. And the things happen. So it's like a person who wants to have lots of friends come in the house, nice friends. All you need to do is actually to have nice food, nice accommodation in your house, and people come in by themselves. You have a very beautiful mind, full of letting go, full of peace, and jhanas come in by themselves. You don't need to go out and drag them in. If you go out of your home looking for them, then you've gone from your center, and jhanas never come in. So you've got to stay in the center there and just wait. So the reason why it happens rarely, because people let go once and they desire for many years afterwards. Make sense? Just let go, let go, let go, and have fun. Can you please explain when the mind is still and then we look into the center of the breath? We is doing the looking. Who is looking? You breathe. We are doing the looking when the knowing mind is in a mindful and still state. Okay. Can you please explain when the mind is still and then we look into the centre of the breath? Who is doing the looking when the knowing mind is in a mindfulness still state? Okay, I think I understand what you're saying here is that with, say you're watching the breath or in an imitator, that's when you look in the centre also. Exactly, how does that happen? Now you're supposed to be looking anyway, you're supposed to be mindful. Remember, mindfulness can be directed to have an object. It's what you're mindful of is as important as actually the strength of your mindfulness, where you place it. And this idea of like putting mindfulness in the center of things is another way of letting go. Because it lets go of this force which throws you out from the center, the force which we call the asavas, the outflowings of the mind, which goes out into time, which goes out from this place, this meditation center here, out into the world, which goes out from your body to the body of the person sitting next to you, which goes out from the breath into all the other thoughts and ideas and parts of the body. This always goes out, and that's usually the force which stops you developing deep meditation. Always going out from where you were to somewhere else. It's called desire and ill will. Restlessness. So to overcome that major force, we actually go in the opposite direction, go inwards. So into the breath, into the moment, into silence, into whatever you're experiencing now. Always going in, rather than onto the next thing. If you do that sort of inward going meditation, it's called insight. It's going inside, and you're seeing inside of things. And to be able to do this, after a while it just becomes a habit. It's just what you do in meditation. You don't have to give yourself orders and remind yourself, because you find that that's the way to develop deep space of calm and peace and bliss. However, that sometimes if you get stuck on the breath and it's going nowhere, then you can remind yourself, or rather the programming, the mindfulness, like I'm doing now, like you could do for yourself, it happens that you're watching the breath getting nowhere and something tells you, go to the middle of this. And you go into the middle of this moment of breath, and there you find a beautiful breath, it becomes so lovely. As if it was right there in the centre. Just like, you know, a beautiful flower where the nectar is. It's right in the centre of the flower, not on the edges. So you go right into the middle of things. And there you find the beautiful stuff. The middle of this moment is just so wonderful, so peaceful. So always going into the middle becomes your habit for meditation. It's the inclination. The inclination of the world is always going to go on to the next thing, on to the next question, on to the next day. We haven't finished with this day yet. We're thinking what we're going to do tomorrow. On to the next meal, on to the next movie. It's always going on to the next thing. But in meditation, it's going into this. So is that actually answering that question? It wasn't all that clear. Okay, if it isn't, you can actually write another question tomorrow. Say, that was a very bad answer, John Bob. Write again. As advice, I'm not worrying too much about the dull mind. But sometimes when I lie down to rest or sleep, my mind, which is lacking in happiness, goes off into fantasy. It is very hard to stop or prevent. You advise me to be kind to myself. How is the best way for me to be kind to myself in this situation? Okay. Well, actually, you start to see whether it's into fantasy or too much sleep or eating too much. See, whatever you do, see the gratification, the joy in it, but also see the danger and the pain of it. And also just to see just the escape from it. And the escape, as I mentioned to someone in the interviews, is very often just seeing that the downside of fantasies, or the downside of wasting time, is much worse than any joy and happiness you get. So you start to see that, you know, what am I wasting my time for? Spent a lot of money for this retreat. I had to queue up to get onto it. Many people didn't get onto it. I was very lucky to go onto this retreat. Maybe next time I will not be able to get onto this retreat. Oh my goodness. So you better sort of make sure you make use of this one. The opportunity may never come again. So thinking like that, you think, oh my goodness, I better sort of get to work. Instead of, so you're kind to yourself, but kindness is not always indulging yourself. Kindness is seeing what you need at this moment. See what's going to be the most conducive to your practice and progress in meditation. So sometimes, if you are really tired, if you are really need to rest, you should be able to lay down and go to sleep straight away. Because that's the body saying, I'm tired, I need sleep. But if you find that you go and lay down and you can't sleep, you just think, it means you shouldn't really be laying down. You don't need to sleep. When I say be kind to yourself, I mean if you really are sleepy and tired, then go and take a rest. And you know that you were right if you just lay down in a few minutes, you're fast asleep. Which, you know, sometimes happens in the afternoon, early morning or whatever, you get up too early and you just can't meditate, you just go and take a rest and you go away, off into sleep, straight away. And that showed you really needed to sleep. If you lay down and you can't go to sleep at all, that means you got it wrong, you made a mistake, you didn't need to sleep. You're just being lazy. So see if you can know the difference between really needing to sleep and being lazy. And going off into fantasy means you didn't really need to sleep, you're just trying to escape. What are you trying to escape from anyway? What you're trying to escape from is the present moment. Because you've got too much of a fault-finding mind. Too much ill will to what's happening. So if that's the case, the opposite of ill will, of loving kindness, self-desire, happiness, and then you sort of don't need to fantasize anymore. Because you're just happy where you are. You're content. And you're embracing this present moment rather than trying to escape from it. You're not going on to fantasies and dreams, but you're actually going in to this. What is this anyway? Does that make sense? Okay, if it doesn't, that's all you're getting. Next question. Dear Ajahn, I did last year's retreat at Ajahn-Tamro, and so far this year's retreat compares quite favourably. Except for one major exception. Ghost stories. Do you have any scary stories? Is that what Ajahn-Tamro did last year? No ghost stories. To tell us to inspire us to meditate all night would be too scared to sleep. Or failing that, some inspiring tales of the Kuba Ajahns. I don't know why people like sort of ghosts. People just like to be scared. Just like escapism. Okay. Ghost stories. I know there's like, he used to be an ex-monk. He used to be a monk, and there's an ex-monk. Sort of, he had this ghost. He used to come to his hut while he was meditating. Because you know what it's like, you know, when you sort of sit cross-legged all this time, you go back to your room, and instead of actually meditating, you either lay down or you lean against the wall with your feet out. That's just to rest your legs. And this is what he was doing. Just leaning against the wall with his legs out, with his eyes closed. He felt something try to pull his foot. Now, it's not like pulling your leg, and that's, it was actually a real thing. And first of all, he thought it wasn't a ghost, but it was actually a deva, a heavenly being, trying to help him meditate. And so he actually thanked him, and then crossed his legs and meditated even better. But then, this being would come again and again into his room. And even when he was meditating properly, he would start pulling him, and poking him, and disturbing his meditation. And he had to endure it for quite a while. Eventually, because he got quite sensitive to it, he always noticed that it came with a very, very bad smell, which is a sign of a ghost. If it's a deva, it comes with a very, very beautiful smell, very, very sweet and fragrant. It was a ghost playing around with him. And you know how he got rid of that ghost? He came in one day. He could smell it while he was meditating. And he was about to sort of poke him or tease him. And he said, "Ghost! Sit down! Meditate! If you're going to come in here, you can meditate with me or get out!" You know what happened? The ghost went out and came back again. So you can be firm to ghosts. Just tell them what to do. Get out of here. Stop messing around. And if you're firm to them, like you're firm to people, they'll go out and go and sort of haunt somebody else, bother somebody else. That's how you get rid of ghosts. Because I'm not sure if I told this story. I told it the other day somewhere, I forget which. You know, like a monastery in Thailand, where some of you have been, in the Wat Nana Chah, some of you went there recently, that's full of ghosts. Because that's a cremation ground. That's where people, on all the villages around, when they die, they go there and they get burnt on the funeral pyre. So it's full of ghosts in that place. And when I first went there, he's still a young monk, it wasn't a meditation, but it was one of those very, very powerful dreams, very clear dreams. So when I left my body and went into the forest and saw all these ghosts hanging around, Wat Nana Chah. And this is a true story, a true dream. Because if it's a samadhi experience, I wouldn't be allowed to tell you it, but a dream experience, I think I can. And so I went up to those ghosts to say hello. You know, I'm a friendly monk. And what those ghosts, they got scared of me. They said, "What? You can see me?" "Well, you can see us," sorry, they were saying in Thai. "You can see us?" I said, "Yeah, of course I can." And they were actually afraid of monks. That's one of the first things I found about ghosts in Thailand. They're scared of monks, because monks have got more power. So then I went to chat up the monk, chat up the ghosts, find out who they were, what they're doing. And in the end, I asked them what they wanted. And I got this whole list of Thai food, which they wanted. You know what the top of the list was? nut trick. That chili sauce. That's what I wanted most of all. And I was so happy that, you know, once actually, you know, you sort of got a relationship with the ghosts, and could actually talk with them in a dream and just got their trust. And they were all coming up saying what they wanted, and please can we get this together? And that's what I remember when I came out of my dream. So, that's a little ghost story about what ghosts are like. They're just like, you know, other beings, nothing different. They're not just like any other being in the world. If you befriend them, they can befriend you. And look after you. So really, the ghosts aren't scary. You only get scared of ghosts if you don't understand them. Don't get scared of ghosts. Have fun with them. I really told you the story. There's some couple in Perth. They got this ghost who likes watching the TV. This couple in the house, they're watching the TV, you know, they're watching sort of a movie or one of these programs on the TV, and suddenly the channel changes. It changes all by itself. And so they get the remote out, they change it back to the channel they want it on, but change it back again. The ghost has got its own remote. I don't know how it works, but it just changes. Sometimes the TV's off, and it just turns on when the ghost wants to watch something on the TV. You've got this ghost in Perth who just watches the TV and he can actually control the TV. It's very frustrating. I think really what they should do is buy another TV and leave the ghost the TV so they can watch the playgrounds they want to listen to. So those are ghosts. Those are amazing little stories. Anyway, can you please explain what are the five controlling faculties? India, please. Thank you. Good one for tomorrow. It's a whole talk. Next question. Can you please go to a loving kindness meditation? Does one get into jhana, or does one do loving kindness when in jhana? Okay, you can do loving kindness after jhana. And then you can really, I say, really zap people with loving kindness. You've got power, superpower mindfulness, and you can really zap. Lots of loving kindness. You've got power, then you can do all sorts of nice things. But you can also use loving kindness to get into jhana. But that's another talk. I've got lots of other morning talks to do, and those are good ones to do. May we please have candles lit all around the Buddha image throughout the day? Any chance of incense sticks? I think maybe that might be against the rules, because incense sticks, sometimes incenses people of other religions. But candles lit around, you can lit the candles all day if you want, as long as there's somebody who will put them out at night time, because we don't want the candles to burn down the meditation hall. Otherwise, it'd be in big trouble. You turn it off at night, okay. Okay, yeah, you can put your candles on all the time. Next question. Ajahn, do two meditators see the same thing when looking at the dull concrete slab or the carpet? No, they don't. Because when you're actually seeing the carpet, really, when you get that strong, actually, it's actually what you put into the carpet is what you see, what comes from your mind. And the beauty and the power of the mind is actually mostly what you see, what you put into things. So it's, the whole world is like that. I once sort of made a description. Remember when I was a child, like a baby, used to have these colouring books, black lines on white paper. And you'd colour them in, sometimes you get numbers to colour in. Or you join the dots up and make an elephant or a house. And that's such a wonderful simile of what life is. A life is just black lines on a white paper. And we colour it in to make Jake, to make Rachel, to make Judy, to make Monk, to make ill will, to make love. We actually colour in the world so much. But what is actually out there is just a fraction, just maybe 1%. And 99% is what the mind puts onto that world. The mind is the forerunner of all things. The mind is the chief. It's amazing what the mind can create or uncreate. So, you do see different things because it's two different minds. You put your mind into that carpet, and that's why it starts to really open up. That's no good stuff. This afternoon, as I went to meditate, the words dead stuff came into my mind. I then had a mental picture, I was going to say breakdown. of you and the monks as skeletons sitting up front, and all of us as skeletons sitting on chairs or cushions. It's very hard to see me as a skeleton because I eat too much these days. My bone sort of got recessed under my skin somewhere. I used to protrude. I was telling people, this is like for those of you who know the Western, I've got a hero which I'm trying to live up to. It's called Fly Attack. Remember Fly Attack? This very happy monk in Robin Hood. Anyway, no, I shouldn't say anything like that. Dead stuff. We had a mental picture of you and the monks as skeletons sitting up front, and all of us as skeletons sitting on chairs or cushions. Why did this happen? Because I don't usually like dead things. What's wrong with dead things? Dead things just need a PR job, that's all. Dead is nice. Dead is cool. So this is actually just what happens. This is actually really, really good, because this is like those Kuba Ajans, those monks in Thailand. So let's say really, that's really good stuff. When you start to see dead stuff and see monks as skeletons. Because isn't that what a monk really is? Just a skeleton, just covered with a bit of flesh. Which is greater mass? The hair and the skin which you see, or the bones which are underneath? More me is bones than sort of, you know, skin. So actually you see much more of the truth of things. So it's nice to see skeletons, because when you see a skeleton actually you see what a person really is. Have you ever seen like a female skeleton, a male skeleton, an Asian skeleton, a European skeleton? I can't tell the difference. Someone showed me a skeleton, I can't tell whether it's sort of really pretty or ugly. I can't. So why did he get into all this business about sort of old, young, pretty, ugly, Asian, European, sort of, you know, girl and boy, all that sort of stuff? When you see skeletons, you lose all of that. You just see a bunch of skeletons. So you don't have any desire, any lust. You just see skeletons. That's very lovely. This is actually showing you that your mind is getting clear and your perception is actually beginning to change. I said this in a few of the interviews, that as you get into deep meditation, I call it like perception becoming free of its constraints. Just the way you look at the world, the way you look at people, is so conditioned by what we're expected to see, what we've been taught to see. And as you get very, very peaceful, you forget all you've been taught. You start to see things new and afresh in weird and strange ways. It's not just carpets, you see people becoming skeletons. Just like you see the carpet open up, you see the person open up, you see their guts. You see them start to sort of fragment. That's just perception enjoying itself. And it's wonderful when that happens. So you actually see, just that's all there is, just a skeleton. You see the skeleton just disappear and fade into dust. It's actually good meditation objects. Narcissus' body, as it truly is, so you don't really attach to it and worry about it too much. Okay? When walking, I have been concentrating on the foot on the ground. I heard you say, observe the moving foot. Am I doing it wrong and should be observing the other foot? P.S. I taught my grandmother walking meditation and now I don't know where she is. That's a really good fact, isn't it? You've got to tell her to turn around if you do so. Okay, that's really good. It's usually more interesting actually to watch the thing which is moving rather than standing, because you do it with standing. I suppose you can actually get the feelings in the foot which is standing, but then you really don't know what the other foot is doing, you don't know where it's moving. And then sometimes there may be cats and dogs in this park outside, so it's good actually to know where you're moving onto. Mm-hmm. And so usually in the case is we usually watch the moving foot. But if it's working for you, you're just watching the foot which is actually standing, and you're getting peaceful, then fine. After a while, when you get very, very slow in your walking meditation, you could actually stop and just stand. So you don't need to move anymore. You're just really, really peaceful in the moment. And when the mind stops, then you can stop as well and just stand. allow time to stop, allow the world to stop, allow everything to stop. And that's actually one way you can take walking meditation into jhanas. Just walk and the mind gets so powerful, so strong, you just stop, stand still and close your eyes, see if a nimitta can come up. If a nimitta comes up, you don't fall over. This question, could you please explain if one leaves family to become a monk, can it be seen as a selfish act if the so-called happiness and security is partly on your hand? Okay. It really depends on your family. If you like, your kids are all grown up and you've got enough funds in the bank there for look after your husband or your wife, whichever one you've got, then you can't really say it's that selfish. Because you've done your duties, you've done your duty to your family, brought up your kids, and you've got enough, you're not abandoning your partner into poverty. So I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to go forth at that age. That's why we've got, like, Abhaya did that. It's a marvelous thing he did. He wanted to go forth as a monk, and so he worked really hard and got a second house next to the one he owned, did it up. He rented out the old house, his wife lives in the new house, she's got an income there, kids are already grown up, he went off to become a monk. Brilliant. He had to work for that for quite a few years to plan how to do that. And good, isn't it? So that, you can do that, and it's not really selfishness. If it's done in a very wise way. But if you've got kids and they're only sort of 4 or 5 years of age, that's a bit selfish because they need their mother, they need their father. But once the kids are grown up and they're independent and you've worked hard to make sure your partner is happy enough with the financially, then go off. Maybe try monastic life for a while. That's actually used to be the case in India. What's it called, the third stage of life or fourth stage of life?
Third stage.
Third stage, yeah. First stage is growing up, then you have your family.
Fourth stage. The third stage is where the husband and the wife go off, leave the kids, and live this any sort of medical life. And then the fourth stage is when the husband and wife split up and go.
Yeah, going to look after spiritual life. You've got all the other things in life. The last years of your life, it's good to actually to put lots of effort into your spiritual life. And it may seem selfish at first, but all those people who go forth as monks and nuns, there's always a few who become great inspiring teachers and create so much happiness for other people in the world. So, it wasn't selfish to Buddha. In the long term, that the Buddha left his wife and family because he gave so much to the world. So if you can give so much to the world, how can you call that selfish? Next question. Ajahn, can you please explain the clear comprehension of wisdom? Mindfulness itself is not enough to achieve higher states. Is that right? Yes, that's true. Mindfulness itself is not enough to achieve higher states. You need clear comprehension and wisdom. They usually just say just one of those. They usually call it satipanya or satisampajanya. And mindfulness is just, as it were, the knowing and the wisdom aspect of it, which goes with it. Remembering the instructions. So you're not just mindful, but you know what's going on. So in the gatekeeper simile, the mindfulness is just seeing the burglars, seeing what they're doing, but the clear comprehension is actually knowing what you should be doing when you see the burglars, stopping them or keeping them out or calling the police or doing something to stop them robbing your house. So you do need the mindfulness and clear comprehension as well. But really to achieve the highest states, there's a whole Eightfold Path is needed, not just one path, because sometimes people actually say just mindfulness is enough. It's not enough. You need much more than that. You need right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right concentration as well, with right mindfulness. They all go together. When the Eightfold Path comes together as one, then everything becomes very powerful and starts to work. If one thing is missing, just like the one screw being missing, then things don't work. Everything falls apart. What experiences or conditions are not caused by karma? That's an interesting question. What experiences or conditions are not caused by karma? That's got me thinking. How does one overcome the fear of creepy crawlies like centipedes, spiders and cockroaches? Wow, that's a really deep question. A stupid question after this. Okay, I'll do the easy one. Creepy crawlies, centipedes, spiders and cockroaches. Okay. It's really interesting in Thailand that we used to have these war lizards which look so beautiful, and the monks loved these war lizards because, you know, they were very beautiful creatures and the markings on them were very colourful, but the locals were scared stiff of them and they sort of hated them. And when he looked to the spider, these huge big spiders in the corners of the room, and the locals there, they said, "What are you afraid of those spiders for? They're nothing, they don't do anything." It's interesting, just the different conditioning of the West. You see a big spider and you're really afraid. And you see one of these like war lizards and you thought they were beautiful. And it's completely opposite in Northeast Thailand. They were scared of these war lizards. They hated them. But these spiders, what's the big deal? The point was, in all of these things, spiders and centipedes and other creepy crawlies, most of them don't harm you. And after a while being in Thailand, that, you know, there's so many creepy crawlies around the forest, and they creep in crawling into your hut at night as well. And the being afraid of those things didn't help at all. In fact, there's too many to be afraid of. So you just accepted them, and they were part of nature. I suppose that overcoming the fear of these things is actually to approach them with loving kindness, and to see that these things are just beings in samsara, and they are just more afraid of you. Imagine your size compared to them. So you're like this huge monster. You know, like in these movies, like Godzilla, or whatever, huge beings, King Kong. I mean, back to a centipede, you're like King Kong. This is a many-storied human being. And you can do much more harm to a centipede than a centipede can do to you. So actually, out of compassion, you can overcome fear of these beings. If you have lots of compassion to these beings, they don't usually harm you. But if you have fear of them, then they sort of can somehow feel that fear, and they get sort of uptight, and they start harming you. I must admit that I had enough natural compassion to snakes in Thailand. Maybe because, you know, they're always for the underdog. And the poor snakes, which has always got a bad press. And maybe it's because it was the snake who offered the apple of wisdom to eat, was that Christianity, that I liked snakes from that time on. I have an actual compassion towards snakes, and sometimes you see a snake, you look into its eye, and the snake has so much fear. That's what I saw in the snake's eyes anyway. And so when you gave them kindness, so the snakes would never harm you. Never harm me anyway. Stepped on them, you know, once one morning I peed on one. With my accident, just after, you know, the all night sit, you know, this is what night I chat, you got up in the morning to take a urinate in the bushes. I thought I'd urinated on a stick, but it started to wriggle and move away. So I apologised. It's good that we did apologise, otherwise you never know what it might attack. So that's actually what you can do to animals. Be kind to them, and then they look after you. They don't harm you at all. What experiences or conditions are not caused by karma? They say that most things sooner or later are caused by karma. The Buddha actually said that not everything is caused by karma, but what he really meant there is that sort of some of the objects of experience are not always caused by karma. The very fact you experience at all is karmic. In other words, because you're born, you're going to experience, you know, happiness and suffering in pretty much sort of even amounts, sometimes a bit more of one, a bit more of the other, depending upon conditions. But the very fact that we have conditions which we experience and know, that's caused by karma, the karma that we've been reborn. So in that sense, everything is karmic. the fact we've got senses, that we've got a body, is due to the karma from our past. It's the same argument is sort of what causes death. What's the karmic cause of death? Being born. If you're born, you're going to die. So all death is caused by being born. It's all the karma of being born. Being shot at war is the karma of being a soldier. If you're a soldier, you're open to that happening. Yeah, there are some random elements, because once you are born, you don't know when you die. Maybe early, maybe later. All sorts of things. Some karma might be affecting it, but sometimes it might be on the edge and just small little accidents might happen. So, you know, that sometimes happens. You know that old joke? It's a joke part. About that. That sort of guy who always goes to the singles bars, always trying to find a partner in life, can never find a partner. And he's so lonely. And his best mate took him aside one day and said, look, the reason why you can't find a girlfriend is look at yourself. I mean, you wear shabby suits, your hair's a mess, you know, you've got bad teeth, you know, you don't even do your fingernails properly. Now get yourself sorted out, and also get a right attitude, be positive. And so this guy sort of, you know, took the advice. He went to see a psychologist to get really, really positive attitudes, right, and good therapist. He went to an expensive dentist and got his old teeth, you know, fixed up, and a manicurist. He had a really expensive hairstyle done and a really, really sharp suit. And when he did all this, it cost him thousands and thousands of dollars. And after, you know, he got this therapist to sort of teach him to be positive and was really looking really, really sharp, he went out for the first time to his favourite singles bar. And just as he was going in, he got hit by a truck and killed. So when he went up to heaven to meet God, he was just really pissed off. He said, look, at least you could give me one day, one night. And look, you killed me. What did you do this for? And God replied, I'm very, very sorry, we didn't recognize you. So that's the answer. The some experience is caused by karma, so even God makes sorry sometimes. That's an old joke. That's a very difficult question to answer. Next question. If someone is diagnosed with schizophrenia and requires drugs, is that person banned from meditation for the rest of her life? Can she never be cured from this condition? What is the karmic cause for this condition? It's usually the schizophrenia, the ones, the condition which you're really most concerned about when people start to meditate, especially going on long retreats. Because sometimes there's many types of schizophrenia, and you really have to find out which particular type it is and just how strong it is, what medications is the person on, and how they're coping with ordinary things. So you just got to really investigate, first of all, and find out what's happening with the person. It's a danger, because sometimes people with schizophrenia, they start hearing voices and seeing visions, and when you get into nimitta stages, if you don't know what you're doing, you've already got a tendency to exaggerate the reality, and you can really go off the rails and start sort of, you know, thinking all sorts of things and hearing all sorts of voices. And as you know, with people with schizophrenia, that just what they imagine becomes more real than reality. It's just so hard actually to get them back into a state of saying, well, this is not right, this is the reality. So it's usually very, very concerned when there's people with schizophrenics who start to meditate. So you make sure they go very, very slowly and very, very gently, and just look after their progress and see how things go. Sometimes they can do it okay, and they don't sort of go crazy, but sometimes they do. So it's a warning. If anyone you know is schizophrenic and is doing meditation, just, you know, keep a close watch on them to make sure they don't get too off the rails. That makes sense? What is the karmic cause of schizophrenia? I really don't know. Not quite sure what that is. Wow, some nice questions to the letter. My goodness. I feel so time is it? You got all night? Okay, read it back, see what it is. Sorry for the length of this note. I wish to share these following discourse of the Buddha from the Numerical Discourse of the Buddha by Bhikkhu Bodhi and ask for your comments. The Buddha gives a sutta regarding the causes supporting phenomena. He says, Avijja is not without supporting causes. The supporting causes are the five hindrances. The five hindrances are supported by, The five hindrances are supported by wrong conduct. Wrong conduct is supported by lack of sense restraint. Lack of sense restraint is supported by lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension is supported by wrong attention. Wrong attention is supported by lack of confidence, that's sadha. Lack of sadha is supported by listening to wrong teachings. Listening to wrong teachings is supported by keeping wrong company. And then the Buddha says, the liberation of the mind is not without supporting causes. The liberation of the mind is supported by the seven factors of enlightenment. The seven factors of enlightenment are not without supporting causes. The seven factors of enlightenment are supported by the four foundations of mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness are supported by right conduct in mind, speech and body. Right conduct is supported by restraint of the senses. Restraint of the senses is supported by mindfulness and clear comprehension. Mindfulness and clear comprehension is supported by right attention. Right attention is supported by confidence in the Dhamma. Confidence is supported by listening to the Buddha Dhamma. Listening to the Buddha Dhamma is supported by associating with noble friends. Thank you for the noble friendship, gratefully, somebody. What is actually this sutra, and there's many sutras like this, it's actually showing like a causal sequence. One thing leading to another. And that's actually like how enlightenment happens. And I've mentioned before, you don't make enlightenment happen. Enlightenment comes from a set of causes. And those causes, you know, from the beginning, is associated with noble friends. And that causes you to listen to the Buddha Dhamma. And that causes faith to arise. And faith arising leads to right attention, as you're attending to that Dhamma. And right attention leads to mindfulness and clear comprehension, to sati sampajanya. And that will lead to sense restraint. And sense restraint will lead to right conduct in mind, speech and body. And right conduct will lead to the four foundations of mindfulness. And the four foundations of mindfulness will lead to seven enlightenment factors, which will lead to enlightenment itself, the liberation of the mind. So it's like a causal sequence. There are other causal sequences which run parallel to that. But interesting here, it starts off with associating with noble friends. And noble friends are not ordinary friends, this is with Aryas, with noble beings, with stream winners and above. So associating with, you know, such beings will actually give rise to like faith in the Dhamma. And that faith in the Dhamma will actually give rise especially to attaining to that Dhamma, because you're really interested in this. Well, this is fascinating stuff. And that will give rise to mindfulness and clear comprehension. It's that mindfulness and clear comprehension. You can't do it from you by yourself. You have to do it with like the seed from other enlightened beings. And that's where the faith comes, the inspiration. It's what I keep on talking about, willpower. You can't do it yourself. It has to be programmed in from outside. Like almost like a lineage, a transference. And then from that, from mindfulness, you can get the restraint of the senses and the right conduct. It's interesting, even like right conduct, like sila, it has to come only after faith. You can't do it yourself. And then from that, you get the four foundations of mindfulness, and then the factors of enlightenment, and then enlightenment itself. Four foundations of mindfulness, again, is a big subject. It's not just being mindful, because as you've heard me say before, the four foundations of mindfulness include samadhi as its cause and also as its result. It sort of dances around samadhi. In the four foundations of mindfulness, where it says, vinaya loke vichara manasang, having abandoned, this is the usual translation, grief and covetousness for the world. That translation you've heard me say before, this is well founded in the suttas, that means having abandoned the first two hindrances. That's always done through the practice of samadhi. So to do the four foundations of mindfulness, you have to have abandoned hindrances first of all. That's actually quite clear. And then from there, you get the enlightenment practice, and then enlightenment itself. So you have a whole causal sequence of the path. how the things work together. There's other beautiful causal sequences as well. One of the very nice ones is when a person experiences suffering. That is a cause for the arising of faith. Beautiful. Suffering in the world. Ugh. And then you just look at sort of who's talking about like a way out of suffering, and the Buddha is. So it gives you confidence that there is actually, you know, a teaching to actually get out of this suffering. And that confidence leads to this joy, pamuja. Actually there is actually a way out of this. It's really enjoyable. Maybe there is a way out of this prison of mine. And that leads to piti, to this joy. And that leads to tranquility. Tranquility of body, tranquility of mind. Which leads to sukha, happiness, which leads to samadhi, which leads to seeing things as they truly are, which leads to nibbida, turning away from the world, which leads to viraga, the world fading away, which leads to nirodha, the cessation of things, which leads to vimutti, which leads to freedom, liberation, which leads to vimutti jnana, the knowledge of liberation. This beautiful natural process. And you see that liberation is just actually a causal sequence, it just happens. Interesting in that causal sequence, I mentioned, like from piti, this joy, you get tranquility of the body and tranquility of mind. What is tranquility of body? It's when you're sitting absolutely straight, effortless, no pain, no movement. You've seen people doing that, you've done it yourself here. When is the time you're most tranquil in body? Only when you've got joy. When you're tranquil in body, then you get tranquil in mind. And that's where you get this beautiful sukha, the happiness, in meditation. Just watching the breath go in, watching the breath go out. The mind is so tranquil. In other words, it's not doing anything. So all the energy goes into the knowing. That's where sukha comes from, happiness. And from happiness, the mind gets samadhi. From samadhi, you see things as they really are. And then, seeing things as they really are, then the real letting go happens. Turning away from the world, nibbida. And then, things fade away. Viraga, nirodha, and then vimutti, freedom. Freedom once and for all. That's the way of liberation, causal sequence. So there's many causal sequences in the suttas, and that's one of them, and it's a very nice one. So say, how does enlightenment work? It doesn't matter about you. You're not involved in this. Which is actually really nice. It doesn't really matter whether you're good or bad, you're skillful or unskillful. It's just a natural sequence unfolds. So you're on the bus. You can't get off, it's too late. So it's just a matter of waiting until the bus reaches its destination. Enlightenment happens. As Ajahn Chah used to say, he planted the orchard. He always used to say this in Wat Pa Phong. So all the trees are already planted. Now you guys, you monks, will only need to sort of hang out under the trees and wait for the fruit to drop. All the work's been done. It's true, you just have to sort of shut up, let go, and meditate. You don't do anything. The work's already been done for you. And you can't stop. So there's a causal sequence why these things happen. Any comments or questions about that? There's another sutta which is said, enlightenment is a natural process. I think it's, now where does that one start from? I think that starts from sadha, doesn't it? From faith. Why do you get faith? A person with like faith and confidence, they don't need to think or form the intention, may I have this delight in the teachings. Because it's a natural condition, a natural result of people who have sadha, faith, that you have delight in the teachings. Someone has delight in the teachings, pramudra, they don't need to make an intention. Oh, may I get piti, this joy coming up. It just happens that way, that's what happens. Someone who gets piti coming up, they don't need to even think or decide, oh, may I get tranquility of body and mind. It happens in the natural course. One who has tranquility of body and mind, they don't need to think or to intend, oh, may I get happiness, sukha. It just happens in the natural course. One who has sukha, they don't need to make an intention, oh, may I get samadhi. It happens inevitably, it's a natural course. But some, this is a word like tamata, like in Thai, tamada. It happens as a natural course that someone with this inner happiness will get samadhi. Someone with samadhi, they don't need to make the resolution to think, oh, may I see things as they truly are. It happens as a natural course that one with samadhi sees things as they truly are. I like that link, because sometimes they say, when we get samadhi, when we get jhanas, then what do we do? There's a way you can go and contemplate if you want to, but you can't stop yourself contemplating. You don't have to say now or develop insight, you can't stop developing insight. This is that sutra actually says, whether one makes the intention or not, you will see things as they truly are. It's a natural course, you can't miss it. When you see things as they truly are, you'll turn away from the world. Should we become a monk, should we become a nun, you won't have any choice. It's a natural process, you just turn away from the world. If you don't become a monk or a nun, you become live just as a monk or a nun in the home life. Very, very simply, away from sensory pleasures. And when you turn away from the world starts to fade away. We've argued, you don't have to make an intention, maybe it starts to fade away, it just happens that way. You don't have to make an intention, oh, may I become enlightened now, it just happens. And when you're enlightened, you don't have to think, now, can I know I'm enlightened or not, it just happens. It's a natural course. The one who's enlightened knows they're enlightened. There's beautiful sequences here, and the best part of that sequence is that you don't have to make an intention, you don't need to think. It just happens. Whether you like it or not. So will has got no part in this. It's just cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. You can't stop it, nor can you make it happen. So shut up and let go. Go on. Yeah. Okay, going from that paradigm of that sutta, you haven't got a choice. You don't have to think, how can I maintain that faith? That faith will grow and grow and grow and maintain itself. Once it starts, you can't stop it. That's also why that some people say that, you know, once you're enlightened, you can actually decide actually to get reborn again for the sake of happiness of other beings. You can't do that. It's a natural process, it's beyond you. You've got no choice in the matter. Because there is no choice, there is no will. It just goes on and on and on. You just, it's not your concern whether you get reborn or not. It's a natural process. And it's lovely seeing the natural processes of enlightenment. To see how the whole thing works and unfolds. It's been going for many centuries. Just goes on now, and you can see all the people at different stages of that process. Just like you see different trees on this, the little saplings and the big trees, and when they burst out into fruit, and then into flower, and then eventually fruit, and then the fruit falls. It's a natural process, that's all. Does the tree decide, I'm going to flower today? But it just happened according to its natural causes. Does this tree decide that now I will let go of my fruit? Or does it happen according to natural causes? Does cancer decide that I'm going to become enlightened? Or does it happen just because of natural causes? Cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. It's the beauty of the Buddha's teaching and his cause and effect suttas. Shows it's got nothing to do with your abilities or lack of abilities. It just happens, that's all. Go on. Fading away. That you fade away, the whole world fades away. All your possessions fade away. All that you own fades away. And the one who owns things fades away. And the one who speaks fades away. And the one who hears fades away. Going, going, going. Thank you. Okay, so that's actually the real ghost stories about the ghost in the machine, the self, the soul, will just fading away into nothing. Is that scary? Not really. It's very, very lovely to see just the end of things. Because as Ajahn Chah used to say, that when he looked at life, there was no end to it. There was no end to relationships. There was no end to children. And you think that, you know, once they're 18, 19, 20, you got rid of them, but they keep on going on and on and on with their problems. Then they have your grandchildren and more problems. There's no end to it. You know, you have white wars. There's no end to wars. You know, you win one, you create more causes for other wars. You know, like study. How much do you need to study? How much money do you need to accumulate? There's no end to accumulating money. There's no end to these things. But Ajahn Chah used to say, there's only interest in things which have ends. The only thing which has an end is meditation. That really has an end. Even heaven has no end. So he wasn't interested in heaven. Yeah, it's such a powerful scene if you're meeting a Buddha. Very, very unlikely that one eventually fruit. But it's difficult actually to say if it's really going to happen or not. But I mean, it's such a powerful scene. I mean, just, you can actually go for, I put a bet on it. I'd give you good odds. You can waste a lot of time. But I mean, if you met the Buddha before, then the chances are, even though there's many monks who weren't speaking, like David Atta, for example, and the Buddha said that in a later life he'll become an arahant. Oh, he was kind of Pateka Buddha, wasn't it?
Pateka
Buddha, David Atta. So he basically became enlightened, even though he wasn't speaking, because he'd associated so close to the Buddha. It was only a matter of time. Yeah, go on, last question, because Ajahn Chah likes to have things with ends, and so that's a bit of about people. Yeah, go on, last question. Yeah, something. He did actually say that, but that was actually a very difficult teaching, because he was only saying that the contents of feeling, of Vedana, is not always caused by karma, but the feeling itself is caused by karma. And he was just saying that, you know, there's things which happen in this life, and what he was really meaning was karma from this life, karma from previous lives. He was actually arguing against the Jain view, as recorded in the Buddhist Suttas, that everything is caused by what you did in your previous life. And the Buddha was saying, no, it's also caused by what happens in this life as well, and what you do. However, if it's the death of a person, that most of the time it is caused by previous lives, and sometimes you want to investigate, why do the relations feel negative about that? Now, why do they reject the law of karma when somebody dies sort of an unpleasant death? And you can actually see many people now who do very bad things, selfish things, cruel things, you know, like in the wars in Iraq. And they don't seem to get punished. There don't seem to be any sort of karmic recompense there. But maybe in a future life they have to suffer the effects of their cruelty. And they have to be like the parents, you know, of people who suffer a very unpleasant death. When you actually see the big picture, you see it is fair. When you only see a small picture, it's unacceptable. The big picture, yeah, it is fair. And what it actually teaches us is, and if that's the result of sort of bad karma, then make sure that we don't do any bad karma. We might not see exactly that bad karma, but we can understand the sort of bad karma which goes on in the world, which will lead to those sorts of unpleasant deaths. You can see bad karma happening now, not that particular bad karma which led to the unhappy death in this life, You can see other acts of bad karma, which we know in some future life, some future place, will lead to similar painful deaths. So that should give a lesson to us, you know, not to sort of get involved in hurt and cruelty. But also we see people live who have very pleasant deaths. And so we should also remember that's karmic cause as well. Too often people look at karma as a cause of bad things happening. You know. But I like to look at karma as a cause of good things happening. Why did you manage to come to this retreat? Because of your good karma. Congratulations. Why do people die peacefully? Because of their good karma. Because they know all about nimittas and just know exactly what to do when you're dying. So also remember that people are happy because of good karma. Not just, you know, to the negative side of karma, the positive side of karma is also important. Okay, so that's enough for this evening. What time is it? What's my watch? What time is it? No, it's now. See, you missed it again. Another trick question. It is now. Who knows what time it is? What does time mean? It might be 9:30 here, but it's 8:30 in Bangkok. Is that right? It's probably 6 o'clock somewhere else in the world. So what does it care about time? So now is no time. So there's no time right now. So now is the best time to become enlightened. So, or now is sometimes the best time to go to sleep as well. So please, whatever you want to do, be kind to yourself, be gentle, and don't worry too much about the clock.